Welcome everybody to today's episode of the Great Birth Rebellion podcast, where we grapple with current research and historical knowledge to help you get the best out of your pregnancy, birth, and postpartum journey. My name is Dr. Melanie Jackson at Melanie the Midwife. I'm a clinical and research midwife with my PhD, which is why I send out a weekly email which contains the resources that we use to create every single Great Birth Rebellion episode. You can join the podcast mailing list at melaniethemidwife.com. Our Great Birth Rebellion premium members also get access to podcast transcripts, additional resources, the Ask Mel a Question button, and an exclusive monthly Ask Me Anything episode where I answer listener questions. That said, let's get into it. Welcome everybody to today's episode of the Great Birth Rebellion. Dr. Melanie Jackson here with you. And today we're doing an Ask Me Anything episode. And I put out a call out for listener questions and I received 90 listener questions. Obviously, we are not answering 90 listener questions today, but we will answer a number of them. And this is just a taster of what's available in the Premium Members Hub. Premium members get one Ask Me Anything episode per month and the option to ask Mel a question in the Premium Members Hub. So I'm doing this one today as a little public opportunity to see what those are about. Today I'll be answering questions on top tips to achieving VBAC. One listener wants to talk about placental insufficiency. Is this a real thing? Do placentas fail after 40 weeks? Posterior babies, why are they considered so hard to birth without intervention in a hospital setting? What does the evidence say about ENTD? Is it overprescribed when it might not be needed? Do I think that midwives should offer free birth packages for women who want support? Top tips for first year midwifery students going on placement. And a personal question. What did you need to know when you went from one to two kids? And last question is, do you see your role as a midwife as saving women in birth? Those are our questions for today. Let's get into it. All right. So first question is, what are your top tips to achieving VBAC? So this listener would like to have a vaginal birth after cesarean. I'm wondering what my top tips are at helping to make that the most successful journey that it can be. So in any birth, regardless of if it's vaginal birth after cesarean or first birth or whatever it is, the two most influential factors that determine the outcomes of your birth are who you choose to have with you for your birth and the location at which you choose to give birth. So these two go hand in hand and they rely on each other. So choose the location you wish to give birth at, and then that might help you make decisions about who you want for your care. Alternatively, you might want to choose who you want for your care, and then that will impact where it is you want to give birth. For example, if you decide to choose a private midwife, then you'll be restricted to the locations that that private midwife works in, either at home or at a hospital with visiting rights. Similarly, if you choose a private obstetrician, you're going to be restricted as to exactly where you can have your baby. And if you're choosing to go to hospital, depending on which hospitals you might be choosing or what are in your location, you could be restricted as to who can be with you. And some hospitals will open up new options and others will restrict what they have to offer you. So for example, I have two local hospitals to me. One will not even book women in to birth there if they're planning a VBAC. And so if you choose that location hoping for a VBAC, then the chances are is you're not going to get one there. Alternatively, the other hospital that's close to me has a midwifery group practice program where women get a team of known midwives to care for them through their pregnancy. And that particular facility allows midwives to care for women who are planning VBAC. So thinking early about where you want to give birth and discovering what your local services are like with regard to VBAC options is my first top tip on how to achieve a VBAC. The next tip is choosing a care provider that aligns with your plans and who's comfortable and confident with you planning a VBAC. And with that, I'll also qualify to say that if you've already chosen a care provider and then since discovered that that care provider or the team that you've got planned for your birth is not supportive of your plans and they're saying things like, oh, well, we'll see what happens, or even if you have a feeling, because that's your intuition telling you that something is off. If there's something in you that doesn't believe that your care providers are on your side and that they're advocating for you, then it would be wise to tap into that and see if you can make a courageous decision to change your care team to people who feel like they are on your side. Because the two most influential things that are going to change the outcome of your birth is where you choose to give birth and who you choose to give birth with. Now, obviously, your birth location and care provider choices can open up and limit your options. And so this is the same whether regardless of who you choose. So the strategy with VBAC would be to try and open up as many options as possible so that you can adapt and roll with your plan. Now, if you're choosing to go to hospital, firstly, get a doula, because if you can't access a model of care that you want with midwives, your doula is going to be a source of support and advocacy and that continuity that you'd be missing out from the system. And then try and access continuity of care, which means that you would have the same care provider with you through your pregnancy and birth and afterwards. So for the purposes of VBAC, ideally this would be a known midwife, but there are also some fabulous obstetricians who support VBAC. In fact, I personally know obstetricians who support women who are planning VBAC for their fourth and fifth babies. So these women have had three or four previous cesareans. So that's what I mean about doing early research as to what options are available specifically to you. I really acknowledge that accessing care services as it is already difficult, and it becomes more challenging when you start looking to plan a VBAC. What's also really important to know is that if you're planning a VBAC in hospital, the current statistics for VBAC success in hospitals, which is from the recent 2023 Women's and Babies report here in Australia, is that most mothers who had a cesarean section had a repeat cesarean section. So that was 87%. 87% of women who went into hospital who had a previous cesarean section came out with another cesarean section. Now, these statistics are reversed if you hire a private midwife or if you plan to give birth at home. And you'll see these stats in the research papers that are in the resource folder. So if you're on the podcast mailing list, you'll have access to all of those resource folders. And you'll see the research shows that women who plan to give birth with a private midwife or at home will have an approximately 85% chance of having a vaginal birth. So if we're looking for top tips on achieving VBAC, my top tip is to pursue a private midwife or midwifery care in a setting that is supportive of your preference to have a VBAC. What we do know is that if you go into hospital and have standard care, your chance of having a repeat cesarean section is 87%. So that is my top tip, is select a care provider and a location that's going to optimize your chance of having a VBAC. And my last tip on this is to listen to the VBAC episode of The Great Birth Rebellion, which we did with Dr. Hazel Keedle. And that's episode 7. It's called Birth After Cesarean. And Hazel Keedle has also written a book on this called Birth After Cesarean. Those are my top tips for achieving VBAC. All right, next question. Please talk placental insufficiency. Is this a real thing? Do placentas fail after 40 weeks? Okay, yes, great question. And in this question, there are actually two questions. The first is placental insufficiency a real thing? And the second is, do placentas fail after 40 weeks? And you'll be surprised to know that the two are actually not really related at all. So let me explain. So to answer the first question, yes, placental insufficiency is a real thing. But it's not what happens to placentas after 40 weeks. So placental insufficiency actually occurs during the early stages of placental development where there is poor placental development. And that's the simple way to describe it. There are way more technical terms. So I apologize to the health professionals in the room. But placental insufficiency describes pathological placental development where the blood vessels and implantation into the uterus and the function of the placenta means that it doesn't function properly from the beginning. And this can be seen on ultrasound assessments of the placenta, and more the technology is getting a lot more accurate as it changes, where it can identify actual blood flow capacity through the placenta. So if you have placental insufficiency that's being diagnosed, we know that babies are more likely to have poor growth. It's also a factor in preeclampsia development, and it can lead to some other things. So placental insufficiency is actually an early stage placental problem that flows on to the rest of the pregnancy rather than something that develops late in pregnancy. And there's a great article in the resource folder on this, which fully explains placental insufficiency, if that's where your mind needs to go. Now, to answer the second part of the question about do placentas fail after 40 weeks, and I know you were probably asking this was the main question, is do placentas fail after 40 weeks? Because, and the reason I think this person's asking is that there's a habit of hospitals to induce women who go beyond 40 weeks pregnant. And some health providers will tell pregnant women that towards the end of pregnancy, the placenta gets old and will eventually stop working, or its function diminishes. And actually, we have two amazing podcast episodes that address this question directly and very thoroughly. And they also happen to be our most downloaded episodes. So I can really understand why these questions come through. So episode 33 on induction of labor, which we did with Professor Hannah Darlin. And also episode 3, which was our episode called Due Dates, and that went all through the research about pregnancy beyond 40 weeks and what the risks are. So I will say that sometimes there can be a change in placental function towards the end of pregnancy, but there are ways to diagnose this through ultrasound. And you'll hear us say in those episodes, episode 33 about induction of labor and the due dates episode, episode 3, that women who go beyond 42 weeks, there is an increased risk in stillbirth, but with adequate supervision of those post-dates pregnancies, you really can mitigate that particular risk. And it's not very big. And also, what we don't truly know is what leads to that when women get beyond 42 weeks. So I will say that sometimes there can be a change in placental function towards the end of pregnancy, and there are ways to diagnose this with ultrasound, and that's certainly what I do to help my clients who are going beyond 42 weeks. We have ultrasound assessment. But I don't think that there's a justification for inducing women past 40 weeks by suggesting that if you're pregnant for too long that your placenta will stop working. And I know that's a really simplistic way to answer this question, but if you go ahead and listen to the details in episode 3 and episode 33, I think that's where you're going to find your answer about do placentas fail after 40 weeks. All right, next question is about posterior babies and why are they considered so hard to birth without intervention in a hospital setting? Great question. So a posterior baby, if you've not experienced this before, if you imagine when you're standing up and you're giving birth, when your baby comes out, your baby will actually be facing your bum hole and be looking at whoever is behind you. That is an anterior baby. That's a baby that's facing the right way. Well, the right way, in inverted commas. A posterior baby is facing the other way. So if it was to come out, would be looking at your pubic hair. But that's the way they're facing. So the baby's back is lying up against your back instead of the baby's back lying up against your belly button. So that's a posteriorly positioned baby. And the question is why are they considered so hard to give birth to without intervention in a hospital setting? So in a hospital setting, birth can sometimes be assumed to progress in a linear pattern where your cervix is expected to dilate evenly and all the way around and opens in regular increments at around 2 to 3 centimeters per hour, and it's expected that your contractions progressively get stronger and closer together and that they should mimic a regular pattern. Now, the problem comes in with posterior babies because often the pattern of labor is different when a baby is positioned in posterior position. So posterior labours, they just don't really fit the expectation that some care providers and some hospital policies might have about how your labour should be progressing. So generally speaking, and this applies to some posterior labours but not all labours are unique, but posterior labours can be identified mostly because they seem to have a different labour pattern. Of the women that I've supported with posterior labours, they have found them to be more painful, and there can be particular sore spots where the baby gets wedged against a bony part of the pelvis, those bony prominences. And posterior labours, they have lots of lulls and drawn out moments through the labour where they feel like they aren't going anywhere. And sometimes the labour pattern can be erratic and just unpredictable. Sometimes there's like a big contraction and then a small one and then some close together and some further apart. And sometimes as the baby rotates, there can be heart rate changes for the baby and they can show big peaks and sometimes some big dips. And I certainly experienced this at a birth recently where the heart rate started to drop and it was worked out that the baby was doing a rotation from being posterior and it was coming into an anterior position and the baby's heart rate improved once it was anterior. The other thing is that sometimes with posterior babies, women can get an early urge to push before their cervix is fully open because the part of the baby's head that maybe activates the urge to bear down can be triggered before the cervix is completely out of the way simply because of the position of the baby. And that's not to say that there's anything wrong with a posterior labour pattern. It's just these are the characteristics of a posterior labour. And because the woman's body knows that there's some work to do to rotate the baby, it's almost like it's creating a labour pattern that might facilitate that. So yeah, a posterior labour pattern is not necessarily pathological, but it does divert from the pattern that many hospital services will be comfortable with. So to answer the question as to why it's considered so hard to birth without intervention in a hospital setting with a posterior baby, firstly, we have to admit that almost all women, regardless of which position their baby is in, will be exposed to multiple different interventions during a hospital birth because this is inherently how the system is designed to operate. But it's accentuated during a posterior birth because these labours mimic what the hospital might labour as pathological. So in their minds, there is a justifiable reason to intervene. And so a few examples might be, with the increased pain during posterior labour, if there are limited resources to support you through that pain, for potentially some extra pain, you know, like water birth, a TENS machine, one-on-one midwifery care, someone to massage you and heat packs and comfortable places to labour off the bed, then women are possibly more inclined to be offered pharmacological pain relief. And we talked about this in episode 47 of the Great Birth Rebellion podcast. And we spoke about managing labour without medicine. So we know that women with posterior labours are more likely to want or be offered or need an epidural for pain relief. And so that triggers off the cascade of intervention. Another example is if the woman's labour doesn't progress in the time frame expected by a hospital facility. So as I said, posterior labours, they can take a little bit longer because there's some lulls and ebbs and flows in the labour that don't allow it to progress linearly. But that's not always welcome in a hospital facility. So women are often offered the opportunity to speed up the labour using augmentation methods with synthetic oxytocin, such as syntocin or norpitocin. And then if the baby demonstrates an unusual heart rate pattern with those dips and peaks that I was talking about, this can trigger recommendations like continuous CTG, forceps or cesarean section, when all the while maybe the baby is just demonstrating a posterior baby heart rate pattern rather than a pathological one. And what we learned from Dr. Kirsten Small in episode 12, where we talked about how little we actually know about normal or pathological CTG, fetal heart rate measurements, is that we actually don't really know what a normal baseline is for a baby that's in labour, let alone one that is experiencing a posterior labour. So, in short, a posterior pattern diverges from a labor pattern that many hospitals would consider normal. And when things aren't within their definition of normal, the solution is to intervene. So that's why it's so hard to have a posterior birth or labor in hospital without intervention. Beautiful. So next question, second last question is, what does the evidence say about anti-D? Is it overprescribed when it may not be needed? So you might only be aware of what anti-D is if you have a rhesus negative blood group. If you have a positive blood group, you don't even have to think about this, but if you're a woman, one of the 10% of women who have a rhesus negative blood group, this question is for you. So firstly, yes, absolutely. ATD is definitely overprescribed when it may not be needed. In fact, most women who receive ATD don't actually need it because the majority of prescriptions are done what we call prophylactically, so as a preventative rather than a treatment. And so if you're sitting here listening at home going, what the heck is ATD? What are they talking about? In a nutshell, if you've got a negative blood group as a woman and your partner has a positive blood group, then you will be offered a product. It's a blood product called ATD, which is considered prophylactic against some things that can occur to your baby, well, to your next baby, not to this baby, and to you during pregnancy if your baby has a positive blood group, the baby that you're carrying. And there is, in fact, a good reason why we haven't discussed ATD on this podcast yet, and that's because I don't really intend on reinventing the wheel, because our sisters over at the Midwives Cauldron podcast have already done a stellar job at covering this topic in their interview with Dr. Sarah Wickham. Their episode is called ATD, an interview with Dr. Sarah Wickham, where Sarah discusses all the research and evidence for and against the use of prophylactic ATD. And she also has a book to the same effect called ATD Explained. So my recommendation on this one is to head over and listen to the ATD episode on the Midwives Cauldron. Honestly, I'm not redoing it because they did an amazing job. And also get a hold of Sarah's book for the best information on this one. I mean, I can explain to you what I do for my clients who have a negative blood group. So essentially, women come and they always ask me this question is, do I need ATD? And the answer is actually, we can check if you need ATD by doing a very simple blood test for antibodies. And so instead of giving prophylactic ATD at 28 weeks and 34 weeks, which is what you'll be offered if you have routine care, is at 28 weeks and 34 weeks or 32 weeks, I'll do a blood test for my clients to check for antibodies. And if they don't have any antibodies, then we can discuss whether or not they actually want to have the ATD. And if they don't want it, we don't use it. And in fact, when I was a student midwife, there was a shortage of ATD. And the solution to the shortage was, let's just stop giving women ATD during pregnancy. And so we did. We just stopped. And then we only gave the post-birth dose because that was considered a more important dose than the pregnancy ones. So I offer my clients an opportunity to screen their blood first before opting for or against the ATD. And then again, during a sensitizing event where there may actually be mixing of the mum's and the baby's blood that could warrant the need for ATD, then again, we would do a lot of screening and testing and determining if there actually has been something that's occurred to cause that. And if there hasn't, again, the woman has a choice as to whether or not she's going to have ATD. And the same thing post-birth is, we can check the baby's blood group. And if the baby is a negative blood group as well, the woman doesn't need postnatal ATD. But if the baby's a positive blood group, we can check the baby's blood to see if there's been any mixing and any antibody development, and the woman's blood to see if there's been any mixing and antibody development. And if both of those are negative, I always offer my clients the option, you know, it appears from these blood tests that there's been no impact to you having a negative blood group and your baby having a positive blood group. Would you like ATD? And the vast majority of my clients choose not to have it. That's just my experience and the education that I give my clients. I always refer them to the Midwives Cauldron podcast episode and to Sarah's book to aid in their decision making. There are also advances in the NIPT antenatal testing, the NIPT testing, which is there is technology now that allows us as clinicians to determine the baby's blood group in utero, like almost from 12 weeks, 10 or 12 weeks, which can go some way to avoiding unnecessary ETD, but it does increase screening for pregnancies. So to answer that question, what does the evidence say about ETD? Is it overprescribed? Yes, it's overprescribed. And if you want to get a full rundown of the evidence, go with my suggestions on The Midwife's Cauldron and ETD Explained by Sarah Wickham. And the other thing I will say on that is if the dad of your baby is a negative blood group, you don't need ETD or blood testing at all, because there's no possibility that the baby could be a positive blood group. You're all going to be compatible. So there's no need for ETD if your partner is also a negative blood group. All right, so the next question is do you think midwives should offer free birth packages for women who want a free birth but also have also need midwifery support or want midwifery support? So if you're listening at home and you're wondering if this question is asking should midwives work for free, that's not what the question is. A free birth is where a woman intentionally plans to have her baby at home without hiring or engaging with or inviting a healthcare provider to the birth. So she's just giving birth without an actual healthcare provider at home. That's what a free birth is. It's called some other things, but that's the wording that's in the question. We're not talking about midwives offering free care to women without financial benefit. That's not what a free birth is. And so this is a bit of a jumbled question, and I'm going to go a little bit all over the place with it. And I think a whole lot of what I'm going to say might not make sense to many of you, because this question is unique about free birth and home birth. And some women and practitioners are in that world and understand the jargon and the politics of it. And I'm going to speak to some of the political issues that I can't really fully explain in this episode. But if it's piqued your curiosity, we have actually done a number of podcast episodes in the past which spoke about some of these things, and they might offer a helpful background. So episode 8 is called Giving Birth at Home, and this was done with my friend Amy Aroha, and we spoke about home birth and free birth. Then there was episode 53 called Private Midwifery in Australia, which talks about some of the political and legalities around private midwifery in Australia. And more recently, we did that episode with ABC reporter Charlotte King. And so those are what I've covered so far about home birth and free birth on the podcast. But I guess my question here is if you've got a midwife on standby, I think maybe what the question is asking is, can women plan a free birth and then also have a midwife waiting in the wings to be called on if needed? So I'm not sure if that was the intention behind the question, but my question is if you've got a midwife on standby, are you truly in the mindset and intention of having a free birth? If there is a midwife in waiting for you, then it seems as though it's clear that you've identified that your preference is that there is the presence of a healthcare provider and a skilled healthcare provider, that you see that to have some value. So do you really want a free birth, or do you want a midwife? Because free birth is more than just giving birth with the midwife in the other room or waiting outside. So this is actually a complex question, and I'm going to say yes, I do think midwives should offer free birth packages, but also maybe not make themselves available. So just hear me out on that one. I'll preface this by saying that I personally, as a private midwife, do care for women who are planning free births. And in the past, a handful of times, women who are planning free births have reached out and asked if I'll offer them specific services. So a few things that I've been asked is, can I come and check the position of the baby? That was during pregnancy. And then the other thing that I've been asked is, can you come and check if I've had a tear and do a full checkup on the baby? And so for me, I always do serve women who are planning free births, because I don't see my role as a midwife to decide which women should have access to my skills and which women don't based on the choices that they're making. So if a woman's choosing to have a free birth, that's completely fine with me. But my little rule is, I suppose, is I'm happy to provide antenatal and postnatal care. But if you're planning a free birth, then have a free birth and don't call on a midwife to come, because that's not a free birth. That is a home birth with a healthcare provider. And so that's my line, is that it's not really safe in my eyes for a midwife to just show up at a birth without any prior knowledge of what's been going on. That's not really how we work. So to bring it back, I think midwives should offer care to any woman regardless of their birth choices. A woman's birth choice doesn't impact on our decision to provide care in most circumstances. So I think to say to a woman that you won't offer them care because they're planning a free birth, it's like a doctor saying that they won't give a woman care because she's planning a home birth. And home birth midwives are always up in arms about the unwillingness of GPs and hospital doctors and obstetricians ostracizing women's choice to home birth and withholding care. But then some are happy not to provide care to women who have chosen a free birth. And so I do think if a woman who's planning a free birth reaches out in pregnancy or postpartum and would like some assessments, then that's one thing. But the no part of this is, I don't think midwives should race out to free births if there's not a prior arrangement and a prior agreement about what the role of the midwife is. We're not just on call to anybody who didn't think to book a midwife or who didn't book a midwife and then wants one at the last minute. So if you're planning a free birth, plan a free birth. Of course, women, when they're planning a free birth, will always have a transfer plan, and you may have a plan to call on a private midwife, but that's how it should be. It should be planned with the midwife involved in the planning rather than somebody just calling at the last minute and asking for assistance if they need it as an alternative to going into hospital. And so that was the issue that was coming up and what we discussed in the episode with Charlotte King from the ABC, is that there have been circumstances where women have chosen free birth, but then at the last minute decided they do want the input of a midwife and then expected a midwife to arrive at their birth. And so I don't think it's fair to assume that private midwives will just show up to a free birth on a whim, but I do think it, in consultation with each other, the midwife and the women can make a plan for how their engagement might work. So yes, I do think midwives should offer support to women who are planning a free birth, but that it should be done with pre-planning and preparation. Oh, look at that. I said that was the last question, but it's not. I've got one more. It's a super quick one. So tips for first-year student midwives who are going on placement. Okay, oh my gosh. Okay, please, if you want to be a midwife, go for it. We need more midwives. Student midwives, you're amazing. Tips for a first-year midwife going on first placement. Here's my tip. It's one paragraph. Adopt a craftsman's mindset or a craftswoman's mindset. So a craftsman's mindset asks, what can I learn and what can I contribute? If you approach your placement with keeping your focus on what can I learn and what can I contribute, you will have a productive and enjoyable placement, because you're going to filter out the negativity that you might see and filter out any bullying or things that you see that are upsetting, and focus on what can I learn, what can I contribute. And if you speak to Jay Hunter, who's a private midwife and was also a student at some stage, she talked about how she used to say to herself, just be kind. And I used to say to myself, what can I learn? What can I contribute? And if you want to go deeper into this idea of the craftsman's mindset, I would suggest reading the book by Cal Newport, which is called So Good They Can't Ignore You. And this talks about all the joy of the craftsman's mindset. And this is where you're going to become a brilliant midwife, if you adopt the craftsman's mindset and also potentially buffer yourself from the challenges of being a midwifery student. All right, everybody, that was today's episode of the Great Birth Rebellion podcast, and the only episode that I'm going to offer on the public sphere for asking listener questions. If you loved this episode and you want to hear more of the Ask Me Anything episodes, feel free to join us in the Premium Members Hub, where I do a Ask Me Anything episode once a month and answer your listener questions. Thanks for being here today, and I will see you in the next episode of The Great Birth Rebellion.